A little late for this now, perhaps given the news of the day, but here you go all the same.
Last name's pronounced Kalanick.
Travis Kalanick, the now former CEO of the company he founded and what it all means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdov. Tuesday, the 21st of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We had Travis Kalanick on this program almost 5 years ago, December of 2012. Forever, really, in the digital economy. And you didn't have to be listening too terribly closely that day to see that maybe there was a chance that he and Uber were going to wind up where they are today.
We don't really go to regulators and ask for permission. And the reason why is if you put yourself in the position of asking for permission, the powers that be are going to make sure you never roll out, regardless of whether it's legal.
I should be more clear here about where Kalanick and Uber are today. Kalanick, as you know, is out of a job. Deposed last night by investors in the still privately held company, unhappy with Uber's culture and the public relations nightmare that it has unleashed. The company, though, largely because Kalanick never asked for permission, has changed transportation as we know it. Arun Sundarrajan teaches at NYU.
Uber is one of the more important mobility and transportation companies for the future.
About the future of rideshare, this figure from companies that track credit card spending, that's how they know. Uber has about 75% of the rideshare market in this country, down from about 90% before the wheels started coming off. And yes, there is an opportunity there for competitor Lyft, but the bigger lesson is about the investor, founder, board of directors' balance of power. Nancy Rothbard chairs the management department at Wharton.
I think what this means is that for a lot of these companies, it does matter what your board thinks and it matters what your investors think in terms of how the company is seen and what it stands for.
One last thing on Uber before we move on. It comes from Christopher Knittel. He's a professor of applied economics at MIT.
In the age of social media, there'll be more and more pressure like this placed on CEOs and founders of companies to be held accountable for any controversy that occurs within their company. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Hashtag delete Uber. Am I right? All right, moving on. The Senate's still secret health care bill. And let me say that one more time very clearly. The bill affecting fully a sixth of the American economy, as we told you yesterday, that basically nobody has seen yet, is maybe going to be made public tomorrow, which is interesting because today is the deadline for insurance companies to decide whether they're going to be in the Affordable Care Act exchanges next year. Some big brand names like Anthem and Humana, as we've told you, are bailing on those exchanges in a lot of markets. Others, though, are jumping in. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington explains the opportunities those companies might see.
One of the companies that wants to expand into new markets is the New York-based startup Oscar Health. Joel Klein is the company's chief policy and strategy officer.
Because we believe, despite all the noise, that the markets will be stable. Too many millions of Americans are affected by this.
That noise might be the footsteps of other big insurers fleeing the Obamacare exchanges, worried that Congress is working to repeal the health care law and its individual mandate, the uncertainty around whether the Trump administration will continue cost-sharing payments, and the fact that lots of insurers are losing money. So why are companies like Oscar and St. Louis-based Centene expanding? Aaron Trish researches healthcare policy at the University of Southern California.
They perhaps see this as there are markets that are about to, you know, potentially have no insurers offering policies. And so this is kind of a captive group of consumers who need to buy a policy.
Insurers that are the only game in town could charge what they want if regulators allow it. And that's another potential bonus, building those relationships. Leighton Koo is with the Center for Health Policy Research at George Washington University.
Some of these companies may say, well, gee, if in the year that we're able to operate as the dominant insurer, we've established good relationships with providers, we've established good relationships with patients, then we're well positioned whatever comes next.
And he points out, these are insurance companies. Their whole business model is built on knowing when a risk is worth it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Oil continued its slide today, down another 2% to $42.53 a barrel at the close in New York. That's a structural thing, really, pretty much a straight supply-demand reaction. Not really so much related to the news overnight from Saudi Arabia that 81-year-old King Salman has installed his 31-year-old son, Mohammed bin Salman, as crown prince. It is a huge generational move, obviously. Bloomberg's Peter Waldman spent a couple of days with Mohammed bin Salman last year before he became crown prince, obviously. We had Waldman on the program to talk about it.
He referenced Steve Jobs at least four times. Huh. He is clearly quite attuned to Silicon Valley. He mentioned Twitter. He mentioned Facebook.
Grew up on video games, you
grew say? Up on video games, yeah. Actually cites them as a kind of source of creativity and skill. He embraces technology. He's a 31-year-old man and believes his society needs to move on.
One of the new crown prince's big economic items, taking the world's biggest oil company, Saudi Aramco, public at a valuation of maybe $2 trillion. On Wall Street today, NASDAQ up, the other two down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've declared inflation dead on this program, or mostly dead, more times than I care to count. And so far, it is mostly dead. But we saw a piece on Bloomberg today pointing out that economists and academics are beginning to wonder whether technology might be blowing up their favorite theory on inflation. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
The inflation model that economists have relied on for years is called the Phillips curve. It says if workers get scarce and the unemployment rate is low, wages go up and companies hike prices to pay for the raises. Voila, you have inflation. But right now, unemployment is low and so is inflation. And Owen blames technology.
I think that it's a factor.
Owen is a former Fed economist now teaching economics at Hamilton College. She says, think about Amazon getting into the grocery business. Grocery stores will think twice about raising prices because
if they raise their prices, people will stop shopping with them and start saying, hey, Amazon is giving me a good deal.
Owen says automation is also keeping inflation low, with employers deciding to replace workers with robots when they ask for raises. But another former Fed economist, Andrew Levin, says tech is just one thing keeping prices in check.
On the margin, it's probably a factor. And of course, it could be a more significant factor going forward.
But right now, Levin says the main reason inflation is low is there's slack in the labor market. People willing to work for less, keeping down wages and prices. Economist Stan Voiger at the American Enterprise Institute says lots of things are keeping inflation in check.
For example, oil has been relatively cheap for a few years now. That puts downward pressure on prices as well.
And Voiger says tech has little effect on prices in huge parts of the economy, like healthcare and real estate. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It used to be that if you wanted handmade dream catcher earrings or really any kind of mason jar-related product, there was basically one place to go. Etsy. It launched with four employees in 2005. It is now a $1.5 billion publicly traded company. However, everything is not so cozy in craftland. Etsy announced today it's laying off 15% of its staff, the second round of cuts at the company this year. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth explains what happened.
Etsy started with a simple idea. Connect people who make handmade goods with customers around the world. They had massive early success and became synonymous with a certain Brooklyn-y brand of crafty knickknacks. But in the lead-up to its IPO a few years ago, Etsy changed direction.
Etsy did well when it just stuck to its knitting, pun intended, and started losing when it tried to do other things.
Gil Loria is director of research at the investment firm D.A. Davidson. He says the big change came when Etsy removed its requirement that all goods sold on the platform had to be handmade. This gave big manufacturers access to Etsy's loyal customers, and the smaller artisan creators couldn't compete on price.
Allowing manufactured goods onto Etsy ruined it for the craftspeople that built Etsy with their own hands.
When Etsy started listing $10 bracelets from Chinese factories next to $100 bracelets handmade by Kelly in Wisconsin, it became a different company. It put Etsy in the same business as eBay, Amazon, and Alibaba, and there's no beating them. The current layoffs are an effort to turn things around and appease new activist shareholders. Venture capitalist Charlie O'Donnell was one of Etsy's first investors 12 years ago. He says the public financing changed the company.
You're kind of dealing with a different set of owners now. You're dealing with public owners that are watching their bottom line.
Watching that bottom line got the CEO ousted in May. Now investors want the new leader to bring the company back to its DIY, artisanal, profitable roots. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
One of the really good ways to figure out what's up with this economy is by talking to people who are living and working and running businesses in it. Which takes us down to Greensboro, Alabama right now, and the Kaiser family farms, catfish mostly, also a bunch of other stuff. Townsend Kaiser runs the place with his dad. Townsend, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again, Kai. How are you?
I'm well. How are the fish is the question. How are the catfish?
They are good right now. They're getting some fresh water from the tropical storm that just rolled in today, and they're happy as they can be.
How are you feeling about the economy in general these days?
I'm very hopeful. We have had a little lull in catfish sales, but that's a post-Lent kind of hangover. But I'm optimistic.
I'm sorry, post-Lent hangover?
Yes, sir. Post-Lent hangover.
Wow. Okay, that makes total sense.
Lent's a big time for catfish. Everybody needs to eat fish on Fridays, and it spikes a little bit of our sales. Some years are better than others, but after Lent, it slows down a little bit, and then it picks back up.
It is, though, catfish is. I mean, it's a discretionary item, right? People with a little extra money in their pockets?
They do. It's a seafood, and seafood is a little bit more of a luxury item. So we're hopeful that the economy is going to keep turning around and people go out to eat a few more times than they normally do.
Why are you hopeful about the economy? I mean, is it the idea of lighter regulation and sort of just a boost under the Trump administration?
Very much so. And that, like I said, that allows people a little more freedom to go out and eat. And that's what kind of drives our market. We want everyone to do well because that helps us to do well.
What's it been like in town? I mean, when you go to, what was the name of that gas station place that we went for lunch that day?
The Mustang.
Yeah, the Mustang. When you go down there and you have a bite to eat or something, what are people talking about?
They're a little bit more optimistic. We're also excited about a few folks mentioning the fact that the president is trying to correct some trade imbalances and that how much that will help us, catfish in particular, but all over the country, you know, balancing out trade and will help our whole economy, we think.
Do you export a lot of catfish? Is that the deal?
We don't. We import a lot of catfish-like species, and we might like to export some, but we would like to slow down some of the imports that are taking some of the markets that we have built up.
Right. So what you're looking for, actually, is you're looking for the president, as he has promised to do, crack down on foreign importers, right? People who are, you know, like the Vietnamese catfish sort of thing that we've talked about in the past?
That's correct, and not just catfish, all unfair trade balances, and that'll just help us all and free up a little more money for everybody to enjoy themselves a little more.
So last time we talked, or maybe every time we've talked, I've asked you about the catfish fry in Washington. So when's that going to be? Do you know?
Mid-October. We're shooting for mid-October to have our fish fry.
And that's you guys go up to Washington and you fry it all up for the congressman, right?
Yeah, the congressmen and women and their aides and anyone else who'd like to stop by and enjoy some U.S. farm-raised catfish.
All right, well, we're going to talk to you right around then. Does that make sense?
I hope so.
All right, Townsend. Thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you soon.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Coming up.
The mall is basically dead at this point, you know.
Thanks, Amazon. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 57 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 21,410. NASDAQ up 45 points, 0.7%, 62.33. S&P 500 down a point, call that flat, 24.35. Walmart rang up 0.9% today. The company, according to the Wall Street Journal, is telling some technology companies that if they want its business, they need to find alternatives to Amazon's web services to store their data. Amazon didn't care a whit, gained 0.9%. The NBA draft is tomorrow, but athletic brand Giant has already signed 7 rookies likely to be high picks. Nike jumped up 1.9%. Get it? Jumped up. Athletic apparel maker Under Armour down 0.8%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note pretty much steady, 2.16%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Ryssdal. Marketplace is in the final week of fundraising before our books close for the year. We're asking you to step up and help support us today so that we can continue the in-depth, independent economic coverage you rely on. Any amount, even a small donation every month, counts. We appreciate your support. So please give today at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I know that people say summer starts on Memorial Day, but astronomy says otherwise. Thank you very much. Today is the official first day of summer, so we are going to take a look at the business of vacation, specifically a vacation that tens of millions of Americans take every year, cruises. Cruises under the umbrella of the Carnival Corporation, one of the biggest travel and leisure companies in the world. Not just Carnival Lines, but also Princess and Holland America, to name just two more. Arnold Donald is Carnival's president and CEO. He's had that job since 2013. He is also today's guest on Conversations from the Corner Office. Mr. Donald, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Kai.
Why did you want to run a cruise company?
Well, you know, I was on the board of Carnival Corporation for a number of years. I almost said no, not because I didn't like cruising or anything, but I had had a very successful career, business career, and I thought I was pretty much done as an operator. And now I realize I was an idiot. I should have been begging for the job because it's absolutely the best job in the world.
What do you do when you're at a cocktail party or dinner party or something, and somebody says, Arnold, what do you do? And you say, well, I run Carnival Cruise Lines. And they say, oh, yeah, that's the one that had the ship that had all the unsanitary problems, and then there was the Costa Concordia. The high-profile nature of the problems you have, I guess, is the question.
You know what, Kai? When I first came on, that may have been the case. But today, people say, wow, I hear Carnival's doing great, and I see you guys have had tremendous success. And were someone to ask me about those incidents that happened, you know, I would just say that, first of all, the one was obviously very upsetting. It was a real tragedy. And the others were kind of media events. No one got hurt or anything like that. And so the reality is cruising is one of the safest things you could ever do. And as many cruise goers will tell you, it's the best vacation experience there is.
Those cruise goers, who are they? Because I think probably in the popular imagination, they are aging Americans, grandmothers, grandfathers, probably not the younger couples and the married families.
You know, I can't tell you how many weddings on board our ships. So it depends what you're looking for. And that's the beautiful thing about cruise. It's all about travel, and travel is all about bringing people together. And what happens in all that exchange of human spirit is people discover what they have in common. And that allows them then to celebrate differences.
So not to take away from any of that, which I actually believe in, but you're a guy running a company in a country where the president is doing all that he can to restrict travel to this country by some groups, to withdraw us from large parts of the international community. How worried are you about the political environment and your bottom line?
Well, for us, obviously, as long as people can travel and want to travel, we're going to be in great shape. If anything that severely restricts travel or causes fear in people where they choose not to travel, that obviously is not good for our industry. Every year, for as far back as you can go, there have always been issues. We used to be able to go to the Black Sea. You know, today we can't because of political tensions. You know, our assets are mobile, and we'll go where we can and take people where they want to go.
When you go on a Carnival ship, does the crew and the captain know who you are, or are you incognito, as it were?
Well, at one point, I had some feelers from Undercover Boss, and I didn't think there was a makeup crew good enough, you know. So, to be honest with you, they know who I am. All of the crew, much of the crew, certainly the captains and whatnot.
Arnold Donald is the president and CEO of Carnival. Mr. Donald, thanks very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
You can check out the rest of my chat with Arnold Donald and all the rest of our conversations from the corner office on our podcast. Same name. You can get it where you usually get your podcasts. This has been, these past few years, an exceedingly difficult economy for retailers. Brands and chains like JCPenney and Sears, Payless, Michael Kors, and Taylor, a bunches more. Places you would expect to find in the not-so-distant past at your local shopping mall. They've been closing stores and laying people off. Some of the malls those stores used to anchor, though, are buckling under the pressure and going bankrupt. Problem is that when they go broke, local governments lose the tax revenue. So cities and towns are left trying to plug the holes in their budgets. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that one.
After more than 20 years, Jim Quigley left his job at a Wall Street investment firm for a smaller market. He got elected town supervisor in Ulster, New York, about 100 miles north of Manhattan. Population, 12,251.
My family's been in this community since 1849.
These days, Quigley's working 60-hour weeks, trying to keep the town's budget in the black. He's been preparing for a drop in tax dollars from Ulster's largest taxpayer, the Hudson Valley Mall. About 2 years ago, one of the mall's anchor stores, JCPenney, closed. Macy's followed. And then
the mom and pops who used to be able to make a business living off the traffic from these other retailers, they started to disappear from the mall.
The lights are working. The floors are clean. People are walking around. But about 40% of the Hudson Valley Mall's stores are vacant.
It's quite problematic for a retailer to succeed when there's no customers.
In 2016, the mall's owner defaulted on its debt. The bank took over. And this year, it sold the mall for less than a tenth of what it was valued at a decade ago. Now the new owner, which didn't respond to requests for comment, is asking the town to lower its tax bill. Quigley says the mall could end up paying $250,000 less in taxes in 2018. That's about 6% of the town's total tax revenue. The money helps pay for basic services like sewers, roads, and the fire department. He says the town has two options: cut costs or
we can do nothing and allow the other taxpayers to pick up the burden.
There are a lot of reasons malls are struggling. Online retail plays a role. In some places, like Ulster, demographics do too. Ulster used to be a company town. In the 1950s, IBM built a campus here where more than 7,000 workers made computer systems for things like aircraft control and missile defense.
This is IBM, freeing man's mind.
The Hudson Valley Mall opened during this era, when times were good. Then the computer giant restructured its business.
When IBM left in the mid-90s, it left a gigantic hole in our community.
The youngest workers transferred. The older ones retired early. Now, 43% of Ulster's residents are age 50 or older, and they don't have a lot of money to shop. Another reason malls are struggling? Changing consumer taste. While that hurts towns that depend on a mall, it can help other places.
You know what I mean? Like, I really love art.
Kingston, New York is a 10-minute drive from the Hudson Valley Mall. On a weekday afternoon, the city's main drag is buzzing with people. They're ducking into shops and eating at cafes that serve vegan milkshakes and quinoa with edible flowers.
I think a lot more people have become conscious of shopping local.
George Volpe, who works at a plant store called Green Thumbs Plant Care, says there used to be a lot of empty stores here. Not anymore. He doesn't think much of the Hudson Valley Mall.
The mall is basically dead at this point.
A recent Credit Suisse report estimates that about 1 in 4 U.S. malls will shut down in the next 5 years. Thad Calabrese, who teaches at the NYU Wagner School, says that can be the beginning of a downward spiral for a town.
It does not telegraph that this is a municipality that is thriving, growing, and the place you want to do business. It gives quite the opposite, that it's a city in decline.
In Ulster, the Hudson Valley Mall's new owner has told local media it plans to turn the property around by attracting national brands with cheap rent. Jim Quigley, the town supervisor, hopes that works. He has roads to pave. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, more evidence, as if we really needed it, that George Clooney is living a charmed life. First of all, he's George Clooney, right? Second of all, CNBC is reporting today that a tequila company Clooney and some friends founded almost by accident is being sold for $1 billion. The story, as told by one of those friends, who it just so happens is married to Cindy Crawford, is that they were sitting around in their neighboring houses down in Mexico, and they wanted to find a tequila that they could drink, and this is a quote from the piece, all day long that didn't leave them feeling hungover, so they decided to distill their own. I personally can't drink tequila anymore, but wow. No, I'm not going to tell you why I can't drink tequila anymore. The Dow off 57 points today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ up 45, 0.7%. S&P 500 basically flat. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.